Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Wyoming Democrats have been in the legislative minority for a long time, but it's been really tough lately. Only 8 of the 60 Wyoming representatives are Democrats, and only 4 resigned in the Senate. While the party has hopes of grabbing a few more seats this year, there are not enough candidates to make serious gains. The problem started back in 1991. Former State Representative Matilda Hansen fondly remembers her days as a Democratic lawmaker. When she entered the House in 1975, she had a lot of friends in the room.
There were 29 Democrats, 31 Republicans, and one independent. And the Senate was 15-15.
Hansen says that included Democrats from Republican strongholds.
We had a Democrat from Niobrara County, a Democrat from Park County, a Democrat from these unusual kinds of places.
But something changed in 1991.
The Democrats are in a minority now, seriously in a minority, because of districting.
A lawsuit forced Wyoming to develop single-member districts where representatives and senators represent a like number of people within legislative districts that can encompass more than one county. Since most of the state is Republican, that made life difficult for Democrats. University of Wyoming political scientist Jim King says there is no question that made an impact.
Many years ago, when there were multi-member districts, that is, each county would elect a particular number of legislators from the entire county, it was a lot easier for a Democrat to be successful as, one out of four, two out of four, two out of five, something like this.
But that all changed. While Hansen and some others blame Republicans for crafting legislative districts that made it difficult to win, King says the mere fact that there are so many more voting Republicans is the real culprit, especially when a lot of people will vote what's called a straight ticket.
There are a lot of people who use political party as a voting cue. That doesn't mean they're automatons. It just means that they understand that if they're a Republican, that their Republican candidate is more likely to share their views, and if they're a Democrat, the Democratic candidate is more likely to share their views. So it's a reasonable voting cue.
After a number of losses in the 90s, fewer and fewer Democrats started running for office. But there is a concerted effort to recruit candidates who will at least give it a shot. Teton County Democratic Party Chair Jordan Schreiber is 24 and has the optimism and enthusiasm that goes along with people her age. But she laughs and says there's a good chance their party candidates will lose. However, there is value in running, if for no other reason than to challenge the incumbent.
Having a challenger forces you to stay honest. It forces you to answer the right questions. And in the end, a lot of the time I'm trying to convince these individuals to run because there's a chance they'll win, but they're also doing their civic duty.
However, she doesn't think all is lost either. While the GOP registration numbers are hard to overcome, Schreiber says the right message and personal contact can go a long way.
I think, you really overcome it by doing the solid door-to-door work and talking to people and getting out the vote. And what's unique about Wyoming is that we don't really follow the same issues that you follow on a national level. So, there's a lot more about wildlife protection and, just open spaces and things like that.
But Democratic leaders and political scientist Jim King says national politics does play a role. The president is unpopular in Wyoming, and King says that is backlashed against Democrats in the state. But Fremont County Party Chairman Bruce Palmer says that means they need to improve their message to voters. For instance, running on things like the Republicans' opposition to Medicaid expansion or minimum wage hikes. He says they also need to be more aggressive.
We're letting people know when we see a vote that we think is not in the best interest of the people of the state of Wyoming. I think we need to point out when we see hypocrisy in our elected officials and do that. And then I think we need to stand for something, and we need to be able to say exactly, what our values are and, what we might do differently.
Palmer says this effort will take time, but he says a few victories should give Democrats momentum. He says the party is committed to improving things in the future, and he's excited about it. Changing gears, the Wyoming Business Council has hired Sean Reese to take over as its CEO this month. Reese replaces Bob Jensen, who stepped down in March. Reese worked for the Business Council for many years and has recently worked for Governor Meade. We start the conversation by discussing whether the state is making headway on diversifying the economy.
I think we are. I think we've created a good foundation from which we can build. I think we see signs of diversification across the state, and I think that we need to identify those clusters of opportunity and continue to foster new growth, inspire entrepreneurial development. What I've told the board through the selection process is I think that the Business Council needs to look at several different avenues. One, we need to think big. We need to think about ways in which we can add value to our natural resources. We need to think small. We need to make sure that we have the tools in place to help small businesses, which are the backbone of Wyoming's economy. We need to think new. We need to find ways to grow that new technology sector, take advantage of successes with Microsoft or NCAR, or many businesses in Sheridan and Jackson and Laramie. We need to think local. We need to make sure that our communities are vibrant places with the best infrastructure and leaders to continue to grow local economies. We need to be thinking global. We need to make sure that Wyoming is on the map, that Wyoming's businesses are export ready, and that we're able to match companies up with new market opportunities here and abroad.
Sean Reese visiting with us. As you talk, and you were obviously talking about a lot of the state, I think what I've heard in the last, couple of years and maybe even longer than that, is that there's been a concern among some that a lot of the economic development that we've had in the state, much of it is frankly been centered on Southeast Wyoming, maybe even more specifically on Cheyenne. Is that a fair criticism? And then maybe how do you get out of that box?
Well, certainly Cheyenne has some competitive advantages with the intersection of the interstates and two Class 1 rail lines. But I think that we are seeing activity around the state. We're attracting manufacturers in Sheridan, growing a technology sector there. Jackson's got some amazing research and development businesses, creating robotics and other very cool things. So we have successes all around the state, and we need to do a better job of profiling them, elevating them, and showing Wyoming communities, regardless of what corner of the state you're in, that there are potentials to diversify the economy.
And, I used to talk to people all the time that would say, this is an energy state. Don't forget that. Just always have your focus there. But there have always been people who have been a little nervous about that, especially those of us who lived here in the 90s. Are we still spending a little too much time on energy, or is that, frankly, kind of what our base is and we are going to have to spin off from there?
Well, I think when we look at developing a value-added sector, as we look at the work that the governor and legislature did this past session in creating an industrial plan, a value-added plan, we have the opportunity to do more than shipping raw commodities or electrons out of the state. So we've got a great opportunity within the energy sector with our great mineral base here, and I think that's something that the Business Council needs to really focus on.
One of the things that people have asked me about, and I wanted to get your take on this, is the nonprofit sector. Have we been giving enough attention to that?
I think that the nonprofit sector, like many small businesses, often are operations that are month to month and that really require that business mentorship. Assistance in effective boards and leaderships and preparing budgets. So many nonprofits are involved in business council activities and community and economic development. So we really do need to find a way to strengthen that important economic sector.
I understand that sector is actually growing quite a bit in our state.
I haven't seen any recent statistics, but I do know that in the past when they looked at how many nonprofits there are across the state, it's a very large sector of our economy.
I'm curious, as you look critically at the Business Council, what's an area that maybe you'd like to come in and just strengthen and maybe, you know, beef up right away?
If our plan is to think big and to think small and to think new and think local and think global, we've got to make sure that the entire organization is aligned behind those areas of focus and that the programs are also in alignment. And so I think that organizationally we need to think like a business, and if that's our plan, that everything is in alignment with that. And that may be refocusing attention or beefing up certain aspects of the Business Council. I think that the many UW partners, the Wyoming Business Network through the Market Research Center or the Business Technology Center in Laramie, Small Business Development Center, those are key partnerships, and I want to grow those even more. So they're not just helping individual entrepreneurs or small businesses, but they're providing some guidance for the state in a higher level.
My take, and just as reporting on some of these things, it seems like those have actually been critical to growing and at least getting the kinds of jobs that younger people might be interested in.
I think so. And, you know, part of that thinking new is thinking about what does this new workforce, what are these new entrepreneurs looking for in communities where they want to live? They can frankly live anywhere. So how do we make our communities competitive? Are the business needs of these tech companies and entrepreneurs, they may be very different from our traditional small businesses. And so we've really got to understand what does it take for the state of Wyoming to grow those small companies, those entrepreneurs? Do we have the most modern, responsive set of tools that are competitive with the other states who are also working to attract the same workforce and the same entrepreneurs?
Sean Reeves will soon be taking over as the CEO of the Wyoming Business Council. Sean, thank you very much for your time. When we come back, we'll hear about a unique program to address dropouts. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio. I'm Bob Beck. Nearly 1 in 5 Wyoming high school students drop out every year. Today, we take a look at a program that aims to find dropouts and get them back on track before it's too late. And as Wyoming Public Radio's Aaron Schrank reports, it's run not by the state's education department, but its military department.
When Francisco Hovell dropped out of Pinedale High School last year, he was 3 years behind on class credits. He'd been in and out of the Wyoming Boys School in Warland for breaking and entering and theft. He was running out of options.
My probation officer and my DFS worker told me I work better in discipline situations, and I knew if I went back to school, then I would age out of school, so I decided to come here.
Here is the Wyoming Cowboy Challenge Academy, a National Guard program based at the Camp Guernsey Joint Training Center. If Hovell was looking for discipline, he found it. Cadet Hovell is standing at attention in full uniform inside a military barrack-turned-math classroom. He says it hasn't been easy.
You learn to look at the end goal, and that's basically graduating and starting your new life.
The 17-year-old is one of 60 cadets in this program. He's been here 5 months and will graduate in just days, but not with a standard degree. Like most here, he'll take the high school equivalency test, similar to the GED.
I would love for every child to stay in high school and make it successfully through.
Ed Meyer is director here.
But the reality is that we all have different talents, different skill sets. We all learn at different rates. And so this program is an intervention to try to get them, hey, maybe you're just not cut out to finish high school, and maybe that diploma equivalent is the better choice for you.
Meyer says it's mostly basics here.
Math, English, science, social studies, and government 101.
And some classes not found at a typical school, like life coping skills. Each classroom is the same. Desks for about a dozen students and three computers in a corner for so-called credit recovery cadets, like 16-year-old Alyssa Vasco. She's taking online courses for real high school credit so she can return to Buffalo High School.
Because I want to finish what I started, of course. And I want to be in my class graduating with everybody that I know.
Vasco says she came to Cowboy Challenge to get away from bad influences in her family and learn self-discipline. The toughest part of being here, she says, is dealing with other cadets.
They don't know you, and you don't know them. So you're clashing with other people, and you can't stand them half the time.
That's what a lot of these teenagers are here to work on, resolving conflict, handling disappointment, working with others. Director Meyer says the program's military-style approach helps them do that.
40 to 60 kids from all across the state never met each other before. You bring them together, you start to strip away a little bit of their individuality, you put them all in the same clothes, you give them all the same haircut, you give them all the same beds and linens and towels, and they eat all the same food, and you start to build that team. And it's not just about me and I.
The program is voluntary, not court-ordered. Probation officers, school administrators, even advertisements refer many new recruits. The marching, the protocol, the uniformity, it seems to be good for some of these kids, like Stanley Smith. At 17, he was drinking a lot, doing drugs, and dropped out of his high school in Lander. Then a former cadet told him about this place.
For me, it was coming to reality that I was going down the wrong path, and I needed to fix myself, or else I really wasn't going to make a name for myself in the real world.
Smith is about to finish his stay here and just passed his high school equivalency test. He plans to move to Utah to get a bachelor's degree, and he says he thinks he'll miss the structure here.
Going back, not having a schedule, not having to be somewhere on a certain time, it's gonna be hard for a little while.
Most believe the program is working, but Meyer says enrollment isn't where it should be. He has room for twice as many kids as are here now. Meyer says he's seen the state's dropout data, so he knows there's a need out there he can meet. But tracking down dropouts is harder than you'd think, even with recruiters, because student information is kept private.
Those are potential recruits, every single one of those 1,100 or 1,200 kids in the state of Wyoming.
Of those who have found their way to the program just in the past year, more than 90% of them are working, in school, or in the military, probably better off than they were before. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Aaron Schrank.
These reports are part of the American Graduate Let's Make It Happen, a public media initiative to address the dropout crisis supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The Great Divide mountain bike route is the longest off-pavement cycling route in the world. It runs from Mexico to Canada, paralleling the Continental Divide. We're joined now by one of the people who created the route and who just published a guidebook for it. His name is Mike McCoy, and he lives in Victor, Idaho. McCoy says the idea for the route grew out of work he was doing with the Adventure Cycling Association. He speaks with Willow Belden.
We have a history of mapping road routes, such as the Transamerica Bicycle Trail, which goes from Astoria, Oregon, to Williamsburg, Virginia. And when mountain biking started getting popular in the around 1980, early 80s, we ultimately noticed that people weren't taking advantage of a lot of the dirt and gravel roads around, especially in the West and other parts of the country as well. People seemed to either be, if they were traveling by bicycle or recreational cycling, they were either touring on pavement or going on day rides on trails a lot of times in mountain biking. And so we realized that we could probably put the two together and to have people tour off pavement on the abundance of dirt and gravel roads that web the public lands of the West.
Now, you've given a name to this new sport. You call it bikepacking, which is sort of a cross between backpacking and cycling. What does that really mean? Why would people do it?
Well, it's just a real nice blend of bicycling and backpacking. You're not on the highway with a lot of traffic, but you're kind of in the backcountry. You can't ride in wilderness areas, of course, that's prohibited, but there's a lot of spectacular country that's accessible by dirt and gravel roads close to wilderness areas. Our goal for this route was to stay within 50 miles of the Continental Divide, which we did for the most part. And it's just it's a spectacular way to see the backcountry, you know, faster than walking, obviously, but much slower than driving. So you really get a feel for the countryside.
Now, this is not a trail precisely. This is a bike route, so it uses a lot of the existing dirt roads that go along the Continental Divide. How did you come up with the route? Was this a lot of you basically biking back and forth on really remote back roads to see which ones were the nicest?
That's kind of how it happened. There was a lot of process of elimination involved. I really drove most of it. I did most of the research in a Jeep because the research trying to do that by bicycle would just be time prohibitive. I'd still be out there trying to figure out where the route goes if I was bicycling the whole thing. Of course, I did bicycle a lot of it when I was doing the research, but we intentionally stayed away from trails and tried to use roads, low traffic roads, dirt and gravel roads where hauling a load is not impossible, which it can be on some of the mountain single tracks.
Now, of course, this route goes through a lot of really, really remote areas. For you, as you've ridden this route, what is one of the scariest things that's happened to you along the way?
One of the scariest was when I was in the Jeep, again, when I was researching the route. We didn't have GPS when we mapped this. We did this back in the, 1995 through 97, so no GPS was involved. So I was following regular maps. My DeLorme Atlas showed a creek. So I got to the creek, and it didn't look too bad, so I put the Jeep in four-wheel drive and drove through it with very little problem. And I came to another crossing about, 2 or 3 miles down the road that I thought was the same creek, but I didn't look at my map close enough, and actually another one, bigger creek, had come in from my right. So I put it in four-wheel drive low and just kind of gunned the Jeep to go get through it, but it was deep, and the Jeep bogged down in the middle of the creek, and I was stuck in the middle of the creek. There was water above the, halfway up the doors, actually, and the tailpipe was submerged, so I couldn't start the Jeep. Just died. I didn't have a cell phone either. This was just pre-cell phone for me anyway. So that was kind of scary. As far as riding scary, I don't know that I've had any really scary experiences.
What's been the response to the route over the years? When you first started it, you've written that you were kind of worried that nobody would want to ride on it.
Yeah, we were, there... A lot of, at that time anyway, a lot of people thought mountain biking was just single tracks, riding on trails. So we were afraid that maybe mountain bikers wouldn't like it because there was very little single track involved. And we were afraid that road riders wouldn't like it either just because it's slower and harder than riding on the pavement. But I think we convinced people that it's a really nice hybrid. It's a good way to travel out there.
Do you have ideas for other bike routes like this? Maybe something that would parallel the Pacific Crest Trail or the Appalachian Trail?
Both of those have been suggested. Adventure Cycling just came out. We have not come out with it yet. It's going to publish in January or February a new 500-mile Idaho Hot Springs loop. That's going to be a nice route, I think. And yes, we probably will do something else long eventually, but nothing is definite right now.
Mike McCoy is author of Cycling the Great Divide, which is a guidebook about the Great Divide cycling route. Mike, thanks so much.
Okay, Willow, thank you.
When we come back, we'll have some reaction to this week's EPA rule to drastically cut carbon emissions from the nation's power plants, and we'll go to Wheatland, where some Wyoming middle schoolers are getting national recognition for a school project. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio. I'm Bob Beck. This week, the EPA unveiled a new rule to drastically cut carbon emissions from the nation's power plants. While Wyoming Republicans say it will devastate the economy, Matt Laszlo reports from Washington that some experts say their outdated thinking has set the state back in the new energy economy.
The White House isn't waiting around for this Congress to help it tackle climate change. The new EPA rule will require Wyoming to slash its carbon emissions by 19%. Wyoming Congresswoman Cynthia Lummis says the state's energy producers are worried.
I think they are bracing for it. We are hugely concerned about the impacts it will have. We will continue to push back in every avenue we have. And they, of course, will be in the position of complying.
About 40% of the nation's coal came from Wyoming last year. Lummis says the Obama administration's attempt to wean the nation off coal won't just hurt energy companies in the state. She says average families should also brace themselves.
Well, it's going to have, I think, a significant economic impact. Rates for electricity are going to go up.
But what can Wyoming gain from the new rule? I took the question to Senator John Barrasso as he ran to a vote in the Capitol.
It could actually be a net benefit for the state. What do you think about that claim? Is there anything Wyoming can win from this?
I think this EPA regulation is going to be horrible for America, for jobs, for the economy, and for the cost of energy. And at a time when the economy of the country is actually shrinking, it's the absolute wrong time to do it.
Many experts disagree. A new White House climate assessment predicts the new clean energy economy will actually create jobs, while they argue the status quo will cost jobs, along with bringing billions of dollars in economic harm from natural disasters. Wyoming Senior Senator Mike Enzi isn't buying it.
I'm still trying to figure out how that could happen. If you drive up the price of electricity, that really helps the economy.
But Julian Boggs, who directs the Global Warming Program for Environment America, says Barrasso, Lummis, and Enzi are deaf to the data.
It's funny because it is the exact same argument that we have been seeing for decades from polluters who don't want to stop polluting. They said that when we passed the Clean Air Act that it was going to destroy the economy and cost jobs, and America couldn't afford it, and America couldn't innovate. Guess what? That didn't happen. In fact, we innovated. We grew the economy. We cleaned up our air.
Boggs says there are new opportunities for Wyoming as the government works to make the nation less dependent on fossil fuels.
America innovates. Business leaders come up with new solutions. We're able to work in healthier workplaces and breathe healthier air and drink healthier water, and we grow our economy at the same time, and we live in a better world.
Wyoming has been slow to get to the table. Take the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic as an example. Every state from Maryland to Maine signed on to a climate change compact that has already yielded a 40% reduction in carbon. Maryland has even gotten more than $200 million from its auction of pollution allowances since 2008. Maryland Democratic Senator Ben Cardin says if states like Wyoming followed their lead, the new EPA rule wouldn't feel as bad.
And we have moved down that path. And the good thing about the rule is it recognizes the progress that you've already made. So Maryland's in good shape on energy efficiency, which we've used, alternative fuels, which are renewable fuels, which we have, the regional compact that we're part of. All that fits in well to the proposed rule.
Senator Enzi says Wyoming is different, though. While the state gets roughly 90% of its energy from coal, it also exports a lot of coal-fired electricity to surrounding states, which Enzi says the EPA doesn't take into account.
And it also bothers me that Wyoming's a net producer of electricity. Shouldn't the states that use the electricity be the ones penalized for it, not the one producing it? That's a service that we provide.
Wyoming also gets about 8% of its electricity from wind. But Enzi is skeptical of renewable energy's long-term viability in his fossil fuel-rich state.
Well, if the sun shone 24 hours a day and the wind blew 24 hours a day, that might work. But it doesn't, and they're already going after natural gas. So without coal and without natural gas, there's not a whole lot left.
Critics say Wyoming lawmakers don't put enough trust in American ingenuity. But Enzi says he wishes the administration held off on the new carbon rule and devoted more resources to cleaning up dirty coal.
They really haven't put any money even into loan guarantees for coal energy to make it better. And I'm pretty sure that you give some young people the challenge of figuring out how to make coal better, they can do it and wind up with some other products.
The administration isn't finalizing the new carbon rule for another 120 days as it waits to hear from average voters, businesses, and policymakers. That gives Wyoming lawmakers a chance to be heard. But after years of court battles, the administration doesn't seem to be in the mood to wait much longer to clean up the nation's air. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
It didn't take long after the Obama administration unveiled new rules this week regulating carbon emissions from power plants for people to start naming winners and losers. Wyoming, the nation's largest coal-producing state and a huge coal consumer, was immediately billed as a loser. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Stephanie Joyce reports, the reality is more complicated than that.
Travis Detai hasn't read through the full 645 pages of the Environmental Protection Agency's proposed rule, but he doesn't like it.
We feel it's bad for Wyoming, and it's certainly not good for our coal industry.
Detai is the assistant director of the Wyoming Mining Association. The rule anticipates states will cut back on coal-fired power in order to reduce their emissions. That means coal would drop from producing 40% of the nation's electricity today to 30% in 2030. Detai says that would deal a huge blow to Wyoming.
If we're not mining that coal, that revenue is not coming into our treasury. Those jobs are not sustained here at home, so it's going to impact us.
Coal mining contributes over $1 billion a year to Wyoming's coffers and employs about 7,000 people in the state.
I mean, is there any upside to this regulation?
from the coal guy? No.
You know, if there's going to be, you know, one coal man left standing, it's probably going to be Wyoming.
That's University of Wyoming economist Rob Godby.
Some argue that Wyoming coal-fired power plants around the country will actually have to run harder as other plants are shut down, in which case you could get a short-term boost.
That's because Wyoming coal is cheaper and cleaner than most of the coal mined in the United States. Cleaner because it's low in sulfur, which is how Wyoming came to be the country's largest coal mining state. Pollution regulations implemented in the early 1990s made Wyoming's low energy, but also low sulfur coal, much more attractive. Gabi says that history is relevant to the current situation.
People don't like change, and that's a guaranteed outcome. But, you know, when they have to change, they will. And oftentimes, you find out that the changes aren't as bad as you originally worried they might be. And this might be one of those cases. In fact, I think it's going to be.
Not only does Gabi think it might not be as bad as some are saying, he actually thinks the rule could be really good for Wyoming's overall energy industry. As utilities cut back on coal, many will switch to cleaner burning natural gas.
And that's good for the state because it creates new demand for our gas.
That could make up some of the lost revenues if Wyoming coal does take a hit. But the potential benefits don't end with gas. Gabi says the state is also well-placed to take advantage of renewable resources like wind and solar. Then there's uranium, which could see an uptick if utilities invest in more nuclear power. And Gabi says if nothing else, Wyoming is also well-positioned to protect its coal interests. He says it's the best place in the country to develop carbon capture technology for coal-fired power plants because coal is so cheap and abundant.
I'm trying not to sound like a cheerleader right now, but it really is an exciting time, and there are a lot of people who work in energy know there are a lot of potential improvements out there that can occur on the grid, in generation, in electricity use.
For all of Godby's optimism, the chances that the state will willingly embrace the regulations are next to none. Wyoming's congressional delegation has already vowed to fight them. Governor Matt Mead was more cautious in his response, but flatly rejected the idea that coal would become a less important part of the nation's energy mix.
Hey, we put a man on the moon. We ought to be able to figure out solutions for coal.
Deb Theriault owns a renewable energy company in Casper. She says she appreciates everything coal brings to the state and the governor's advocacy for it, but she hopes it doesn't come at the expense of other energy resources.
It would be nice to see him give credence and credibility and think about how renewables could fit into that mix instead of just sort of putting the blinders on and saying, we're gonna go with the way we've always done it.
If the rule goes into effect, doing it the way it's always been done won't be an option. But Wyoming will get to choose whether it's seen as an opportunity or as a burden. The rule now goes to a 120-day comment period. It's expected to be finalized next year. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Changing gears, some Wyoming middle schoolers are getting national recognition for a school project they say has life-saving potential. Wyoming Public Radio's Aaron Schrank reports.
When 4 8th graders at Wheatland Middle School were asked to put their heads together to solve a real problem in their community, they thought back to the biggest crisis in recent memory, the quarter-mile-wide twister that touched down near their town in 2012.
I actually went and did cleanup for this and saw the devastation firsthand, and it was just a really big, big thing.
That's Jacob Stafford. He says he and his classmates, Joey Madsen and twin brothers Hayden and Christian Moody, remember the day the tornado hit very well, and it made an impression on them because it was just miles from their school.
We remember having to kneel down in front of the lockers outside with books over our head. Of course, that's not going to protect us from any sort of tornado.
So the group set out to build something better, a heavy-duty tornado shelter. Hayden Moody says they didn't have to look far to find building material.
We were looking around, it's like, what could protect us better than these textbooks? And so we're looking at these giant metal lockers that were leaned up against. It's like, hey, these would probably do pretty good against a cinder block. So we kind of just went with the idea of how common these things are and how almost every school has them.
They spent the next few months researching, designing, and building a prototype tornado shelter. It's basically a row of five ordinary school lockers on a sliding steel frame. Stafford proudly shows it off.
We have these spring-loaded handles. And it slides out so smooth on rough concrete.
The boys' invention is now in its deployed position. The bottom of the row of lockers has been rolled a couple of feet forward, and the unit is slanted back against the steel frame, leaving students enough room to crawl underneath the lockers and take shelter.
And this angle right here is a 45-degree angle, which is optimum for deflecting debris.
And they did put the structure to the test, pelting it with cinder blocks and dropping heavy wooden pallets on it from the school roof. Hayden Moody says it held up pretty well.
It performed beyond our expectations. The most damage that it ever sustained was scratches and one broken off handle for a locker, and even then, that's just because the handles are external.
The boys tested their invention further when they entered it into a science, technology, engineering, and math competition called E-Cyber Mission, sponsored by the Army. They won first place in the region and will head to Washington, D.C. this month for nationals. Stafford says they're excited.
We're four kids from Wheatland, Wyoming, a nobody of a town, and we're just ecstatic that we're able to make it this far.
Jacob, we need an engineering diagram for the modifications.
They say they owe much of their success to their science teacher and project advisor, Mikan Harnish.
You guys need to get that done.
She's been entering students in this competition for the last 5 years and says this kind of hands-on STEM education is crucial.
It takes science out of just textbooks and we're just learning science. It puts us in the position of doing science. And to watch what these kids are capable of is just amazing when you actually let them do the science and not just learn about it or read about it. It's so important to me.
Harnish has motivated the boys, but she wasn't the only motivating factor. Christian Moody says the first prize check from the Army also helped.
Oh, well, each of us got $3,000 in savings bond, so overall the team has about $12,000.
If they win at nationals, they each stand to earn $5,000 more. Joey Madsen says the group has plans for some of their winnings.
We're thinking of getting a patent attorney and then selling the patent or maybe even starting a company out of this and maybe selling these lockers and turning a profit on them also.
These boys mean business, so much so that even though school is ending for the summer, Madsen says they're not going anywhere.
We'll be coming back almost every day, working to get our idea better and get ready for Washington, D.C.
They'll be up against four other teams of eighth graders from around the country, including a group of girls from Oklahoma with a competing tornado shelter project. For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Aaron Schrank.
For photos of the Wheatland team and their creation, log on to wyomingpublicmedia.org. These reports are part of the American Graduate Let's Make It Happen, a public media initiative to address the dropout crisis supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. We'll wrap things up in a moment. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. A new album by Jackson Hole jazz singer Nicole Madison jazzes up a 60s pop song and gives it a place among classic jazz standards. The album's name, In My Life, comes from a song written by the Beatles. Wyoming Public Radio's Micah Schweitzer reached out to Nicole Madison at home.
So the album has a lot of the classic American songbook names in terms of composers on it: Rodgers, Hart, Hammerstein, Arlen, Gershwin. And then I also see Lennon and McCartney, as in the Beatles. How did they make it on that list?
Actually, I had sung that song about a year ago. I was asked to sing that at a party and really liked the song and brought it to Keith.
And this is Keith Phillips, your pianist.
Yes. I honestly felt like it was one of Keith's best arrangements. I loved what he did with it. It feels to me and sounds to me like one of the most honest expressions of him coming through the song.
There are places I'll remember all my life. Though some have changed, some forever, not for better. And some have gone, and some remain.
And I have to say also what struck me in listening to it, because it's a song, you know, the Beatles are pretty ubiquitous, so it's a song I've heard a lot, but the lyrics really popped for me in a way that they haven't before. I feel like the melancholy of the song really comes through in your interpretation and your arrangement.
Well, thank you, Micah. I appreciate that. You know, in what I do in my performing, I try to find the most honest expression of myself in the communication of the lyric.
And does this have anything to do with the fact that before your career in jazz, you worked in musical theater in New York?
Yes, I worked in musical theater in theater. And for me, acting and music are interconnected. And trying to find the truth in all of my performing is one of my main goals in order to move people. That's really what I want to do. I want to move and inspire people through all that I do with performance.
I can't give you anything but love, baby. That's the only thing I've plenty of, baby.
How do you approach well-known material? I mean, you've also got Over the Rainbow or I Can't Give You Anything But Love on the album. I mean, these are well-trodden paths.
They most certainly are. I do my best to honor the integrity of the songwriter. And then I try to find my own take on it. And it's at times a challenge because some of the standards are so overdone. But I feel very connected to that style of music and just do my best to give an honest interpretation.
Nicole Madison, tell me a bit about the process of developing these interpretations. I mean, you've talked about your pianist, Keith Phillips, working on arrangements for these pieces. What happens next in the rehearsal space?
We play through the songs quite a bit together, and then I take the material home and work on it on my own. I analyze those lyrics like crazy and try to put it into my body and communicate it in a way that it really is the most honest expression of myself. But then we come back together and work on the piece. And not only are we expressing our own message individually, we're coming together and trying to communicate something together.
Tell me a little bit about what it's like to be a jazz musician in the West, which is, obviously there are jazz players in this area, but it's not an area that's typically thought of as a hotbed for jazz.
I think living out West, it provides a bit of a challenge because you are limited in the access of going out and hearing different musicians and so forth. I mean, at least out here, you know, not so much on the West Coast. At the same time, it also offers you freedom of, I think, working on your own individual expression as an artist.
Nicole Madison is a jazz singer living in Jackson Hole. We reached her by phone at her home. Her new album is In My Life, and you can find out more about Nicole and her music at NicoleMadison.com. Nicole Madison, thanks so much for your time.
Micah, thank you for having me. I'm honored.
And it's time now for Wyoming Stories. On this D-Day anniversary, we'll hear recollections from a more recent war. Jason Williams is an Iraq war veteran from Lander. In 2004, Williams was part of a Marine expeditionary unit sent to Najaf.
We were part of the 11th MEU, the Marine expeditionary unit. We offloaded
in Kuwait, and then we flew into Iraq. The overall mission was is that a guy by the name of Muttad al-Sadr raised a militia and was causing a lot of problems in the Jaf, and so they had us go in there and start clearing it out. I remember we were going into the city, and I ended up jumping out of the back end of the 7-ton and just posting security, just checking out the surrounding areas, making sure that nobody was going to try to ambush us or anything. And a kid that couldn't have been more than 8 years old came up. He started pointing at me, and then he pointed into town, and then he pointed back at me, and then he made a rifle gesture, and then he pointed back at me, and then he ran his thumb across his throat, and he pointed at me again. You know, he was basically telling me that if we go into town, we were all going to die. And I was just like, wow, this kid's 8 years old, and he's telling me already that I'm going to die. These kids already know what fighting is, what war is and stuff. And here I am, this naive 18-year-old. I'm a Marine, but I hadn't experienced war or anything yet. We got the order to keep going into Najaf. And I remember laying down behind the curb of this street. And I was looking out in this field because it was just a bunch of dirt. And I can remember just these little puffs of smoke coming up, or little puffs of dirt coming up. I thought, how peculiar. That's so weird. What is going on over there? You know, and I looked over to my side and I said, hey, do you see this? What's going on with all those little dirt puffs? And my team leader was just like, oh, man, those are bullets, dude. You know, like, what do you think they are? I'm like, oh. And I remember distinctly laughing and telling some of my buddies to watch my hand because it was shaking uncontrollably. I couldn't stop it from shaking. There was just so much adrenaline and I was just so scared. Even though I hadn't been engaged and I wasn't shooting back at anyone or anything, the threat was there. The idea that somebody was trying to kill you was actually all the more real. Yeah, it wasn't training anymore. We were actually doing it for our work. It was what we were paid to do. It was what we were trained to do. And now we were actually doing it. And so they drove a couple of the M1A1 Abrams tanks through these huge walls that were surrounding the cemetery because that's where they figured out that these guys were at. And so this cemetery is 3 miles by 5 miles long. And so we ended up going through these big, huge holes that these tanks had crashed through the walls so we could get into the cemetery and start clearing it out. And the cemetery was so big that you couldn't even see the guy to your left or to your right. You were kind of all alone. It was really, really scary. And they bury their dead on top of each other. And there's so many graves there that you would have to crawl over the graves to go forward. And so my friend and I, we were sitting behind these two graves and we were getting shot at. We didn't know where the fire was coming from, who was shooting at us and stuff like that. And so I was sitting with my back against one grave and he had his back against another grave. And we both ended up looking out in the same direction between these two graves to see if we could see anything. And probably the loudest snap I've ever heard in my life. It was like someone would take 2x4s and they were so elastic that they would whip them together. And if you can imagine those two boards colliding and then at the very end with the snap, that loud crack, that's what happened. Somebody had seen my friend and I and taken a shot at us, and that bullet had passed right between both of our heads. And there's a big bullet hole, you know, right between both of our heads in this grave right behind us. And we both fell backwards, and we were sitting there, and we were just like, whoa, you know? I mean, you know, you kind of have to take a humorous approach to it because it's scary, and it scared us to death. And so, you know, we were both sitting there laughing. You know, and I mean, that's probably not the best thing to do, but what else can you do?
That's Iraq War veteran Jason Williams from Lander. You can hear more Wyoming stories on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. That's our program for today. If you have a topic or idea for future shows, you want to hear this program again or listen to individual segments, you can go to that website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. Just simply click on Open Spaces. Anna Rader is our web editor. We invite you to become a fan of our Facebook page called Wyoming Public Radio News, and all of our reporters are on Twitter. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.